Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra opens the Philharmonic season with great legends and a beloved piano concerto. RPO Music Director Ward Stair joins me today to talk about the three fabulous pieces in their season opener for the year. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Nice to see you again.
And was your summer fruitful?
Yeah, it was fruitful. It was felt quick. It always feels quick, but they seem to be getting shorter and shorter. But I had a great summer.
They get shorter and shorter because we get older and older. That's what I'm
saying. And busier and busier, I think, is another thing.
That's very true. So when you take time off and you come back with the orchestra, is the orchestra really just primed and ready to go, or is everybody still a little in that vacation mode?
Well, I mean, I think everyone's always excited to come back together and make music because, you know, it's good to have a little bit of time off. And a lot of our musicians go to other music festivals in the summer and, you know, play with other great colleagues from other orchestras. So, and that's a great experience. And they always bring that back with them when we come together in September. And, you know, we pick up right where we left off. It's wonderful.
So the program that you have lined out is a fabulous program that begins with Richard Strauss's tone poem, Don Juan. Now, I heard a rumor that you kind of like Richard Strauss's music.
Just a little bit, yeah.
Just a little bit. So you have this great sweeping tone poem to get things kicked off. What do you love about this piece?
Oh, there's so much. Well, first of all, the character of it is just fantastic. You probably know that Strauss based this on a poem by Nicholas Lenau rather than some other interpretations of the Don Juan legend. So this is actually not so dark and nasty. I mean, if you're familiar with Don Giovanni, you know, Mozart's great opera, you know, he's a pretty awful character throughout the entire drama, and at the end he gets dragged down to hell, and you know, it's very, very dark and intense. And this is a lot more carefree. This is more, Strauss is more interested in the poetry because it talks about the kind of hopeless romantic angle of it much more than the, you know, predatory, you know, guy who's, you know, mistreating all these women and discarding them and, you know, going off. He actually, the poem talks more about how Don Juan is is using his quest to find his perfect love, his ideal match, as an excuse for all this promiscuity. You know, he says it's a little better. I didn't say it was like totally better, but it's a little bit better in terms of, you know, there's no malicious intent. He's just going from one conquest to another because he's actually searching for his ideal mate and his true love and all that. So it's a little more lighthearted, you know, and you get this great energy throughout. Right in the opening bars, there's just a great explosion of color and energy in the entire orchestra. And you get most of the themes are presented early on, and they're very bold, they're very lyrical, they're sweeping, soaring. I mean, we really take off immediately, right away. It's a fantastic way to open any program, and especially to open a season. And in the middle, there's a lot of really beautiful lyrical playing. There's a great sort of seduction scene where the cellos and the violas are playing this very provocative, you know, sort of, I don't know, sexy swagger kind of motif. And the flute player is sort of bashful, you know, trying to resist the advances of Don Juan. And then it escalates. There's another attempt and then more resistance. And then finally, the tension is broken. And it's like, and then you get into this beautiful love duet, which is just so gorgeous. The oboe has a beautiful solo joined by the clarinet, the bassoon, you know, all these wonderful, wonderful lines that Strauss writes in the orchestra, supported beautifully by the color and the strings and this just wonderful velvet carpet that's laid out underneath all this great playing in the woodwinds. Is fantastic.
So this would be that moment in Don Juan's life where he thinks he's found the one?
Well, maybe. But then as soon as it comes to kind of a resting place, and then it's almost like he thinks, no, I need to keep looking, and he tiptoes out of the bedroom, and then he's off again. And then you get, you know, some more of the robust, you know, main theme Don Juan music as he's running about. You get an episode where people are laughing at him. There's all this, there's a little jocoso, scherzando kind of music. And it's around that time that you get a feeling of the desperation that enters, and then the themes become a little bit more insistent, a little bit more urgent. And finally, Don Juan, you know, sort of throws caution to the wind and just is a little reckless. And then he gets into another episode and he winds up being challenged to a duel. And in the poem, you know, he knows that he's much more powerful than this person who challenged him to a duel. I mean, he knows that he's going to win, but he's sort of, his heart's broken, or he says he feels empty because he hasn't been able to find this love he's been looking for. So he intentionally loses the duel. He falls on this guy's sword. And you hear that moment in the music, too. It just winds up to this tremendous climax, and then, boom, Strauss just pulls the carpet out from under us, and then you get this really eerie, hollow chord, and you hear just that little sharp, there's an accent in the trumpets where it's like this little pang, or the actual pain of the blade going in, and then the strings almost unravel, and you can picture Don Juan sort of slumping after this episode, and the whole thing ends actually very quietly. It's amazing. Starts in E major, ends in E minor. So it's a unique take on the Don Juan legend, and the orchestral writing is brilliant. Everybody's got something great to do, and it's a real showpiece for the entire orchestra.
And it launched his career.
It did, yeah. It's an early work, an early tone poem, and he really sort of planted his flag as a great master composer and a great tone poet, and we know all the great tone poems that came afterward, and then, of course, that's to say nothing of his fantastic operas.
Now, this was a very special time in Richard Strauss's life, too, because this was about the time that he met the love of his life, the beautiful Pauline de Agna, who would eventually become his wife.
Yeah, yeah. She was an inspiration for so much of his career. I mean, he wrote pieces and operas that are, some of them are refer to his domestic life, you know, very from a distance and very, you know, clever ways, and others are a lot more obvious. But she was clearly an essential part of his life. So it is interesting that they were getting together around this time, too.
And this was a piece where, and Richard Strauss is known for his horn writing, and it sure does show up here, but this is a piece where all of his wind writing really shines. His wind writing is really spectacular, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, you remember his father was a horn player, so he was very comfortable and familiar with especially the horn, but I think also all the woodwinds, and he had a great knack for the orchestration and how to layer them, how to create moments where just this fantastic spectrum of color comes through in all sorts of great ways.
And he was just 24 when Strauss wrote this, so why was this particular piece? Because we hear it from modern ears, what we hear. Yeah, yeah, right, right. But back then, what made this so revolutionary?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of composers hadn't dared to write such amazing sweeping figures for the strings, for one thing. I mean, there's a famous story that the first time Strauss rehearsed it with the orchestra, the string players almost killed him, and he could see them all, you know, sweating bullets and just dying trying to play these figures. And now, of course, it's standard repertoire, so every string player knows how to execute it, but it's really difficult. I mean, it's fun to imagine what that first reading must have been like when he gave the downbeat, and they said, what? It's that tempo, and this is how you wrote it? Strauss himself said, you know, the looks on their faces were just priceless, but he said he was smiling because it might have been really difficult, and while he felt bad for them, it sounded fantastic.
Now, this begs a question, that when you are doing a concert, your orchestra all gets their music well in advance, they get to take it home, and they work on it, they do their sectionals, blah, 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 blah. How early would the orchestra have gotten this music? Was this a matter of being a cold call, basically? They came in, sat down, and looked at that for the first time?
You mean at the premiere?
Yeah.
It's hard to know. It could have been, which would have been even more shocking. Yeah. And I think the other thing that made this so revolutionary for Strauss and so important in his own development is he, it wasn't long before, and he writes about this, you can read a lot about it actually, when he was growing up, his father, you know, being a very proper musician, he basically raised Strauss on Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, maybe a little Schubert. He had no idea about Wagner or Liszt. And it was shortly before he composed Don Juan that he actually discovered Wagner and Liszt, sort of the other side of, you know, the battle in the great romantics. And he was obviously very taken by their music, and it opened up a whole world of possibilities. I mean, he uses leitmotif, you know, and that comes directly from Wagner and Liszt. Some of his harmonic devices are very Wagnerian, these long pedals that he'll use with these great diminished chords suspended over the top of them. And that kind of musical language is really what makes Strauss and Strauss's voice unique, I think. But it really, in a lot of ways, started with Don Juan.
And then you continue giving the poor orchestra, and especially the horn section, a workout by rolling right into Grieg's Piano Concerto. Mm. Very nice of you.
Well, I don't think the horns are complaining. I think they're having a great time, actually, this week.
Their lips aren't falling off.
No.
So you've picked the Grieg Piano Concerto in A minor. Enon Barnaton will be the soloist with that. And this is one of the most beloved of all piano concertos. It has a great open to it, for mm-hmm. sure.
Very famous opening, this great dramatic roll of the timpani, and then just a one chord struck very crisply by the orchestra, and then the piano solo plays that famous descending line, and then we're in, and it's a great piece. And I like it on this program because it fits well with the storytelling element and the dramatic element. I mean, it's such a... The concerto is so beautiful. It's very lyrical, and it's very dramatic all at the same time. And it's well-written for the orchestra. It's a great piece for the audience because I think it's familiar and also because it's a great piece. So I think all around it'll be a great, great program.
The three movements of the piano concerto are very different.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is that big... sweeping, crashing, relentless forward momentum kind of thing that you would expect from your basic romantic piano concerto.
Mm-hmm. It's very grand. It's very, I mean, I think of it as majestic too, the first movement. It's, you know, it's, you can sort of spread your wings and, you know, just really strut your stuff. And the second movement is complete contrast because it's so intimate and so beautiful and just exquisite in some of the small details that can be brought out, and the lyricism and the soft playing, which is very, very important. And you have to pay very close attention to the soft playing always, of course, but especially in the second movement to make it really come off.
And again with the horn.
Yeah, there's beautiful, beautiful horn moments, beautiful horn solo, nice little dialogue, couple moments where the horn and the piano soloist are almost just playing chamber music. It's really what it is.
And then the final movement, again, it's very different from that second movement with very little pause.
Mm-hmm.
It rolls into something that sounds like what we know Grieg for, which is those folk songs, those mm-hmm. folk dances. It sort of gets that... tromping around dance thing going.
It's a little more festive. It's just kind of a little romp at the end. I mean, it's it really skips along quite nicely, and then it goes even faster at the end, goes into one. There's a little, it's a dance, you know, it's just fun. It's a wonderful way to end the piece.
Now, it does pause for a moment.
There's a little stopping and starting, but, and there, you know, there's those great and almost operatic, dramatic moments, you know, where there's little cadenza. Well, there are some big cadenzas, and then there's some shorter cadenzas where we punctuate them with big chords in the orchestra, and it's all very exciting.
And just like Richard Strauss's Don Juan, this was a hit right out of the box.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
This was a smash.
Yeah, for obvious reasons, I think.
So here's my question. Grieg was a very good pianist. His nickname was the Chopin of the North. He wrote all of these little lovely piano things, and they got a huge success with this one. He only wrote the one piano concerto.
I know. Strange. I don't know why. Good question.
You don't have his phone number?
I don't. No, he changed his number, and you know, he didn't answer my last few texts, so I can't ask him.
Grieg was about the same age as Richard Strauss was when he wrote this. They were about the same age. Was this concerto considered daring?
I don't think it was considered really too daring or revolutionary at the time it was written. I mean, it was a good piece. You know, it's not stodgy in any way, but I don't think you really broke any ground, so to speak, with it.
Grieg was once said, artists like Bach and Beethoven erected churches and temples on ethereal heights. I want to build homes for people in which they can be happy and contented.
That's great. I haven't ever heard that quote, actually. That's a nice one.
His music, orchestrally, he doesn't have a lot of it, does he?
No, there really isn't a lot of it, but a lot of what he did write has made its way into the standard repertoire, so I think he was successful.
Must have been. I know Liszt loved this piano concerto. Mm. He did like a lot of, he played it a lot. He mm-hmm. pushed it really, really heavily. So mm-hmm. I guess Liszt set both Grieg and Strauss off for various reasons, for different reasons into their various careers. Mm-hmm. You'll have to write him a thank you note.
Yeah, okay. We'll get on that.
So what is the secret sauce with this concerto? Why do you think it was just loved right out of the box?
Oh, because, you know, like I said, it's got great dramatic elements. It's got good tunes. It's well written for the piano and the orchestra alike. And the way it's put together, the structure of it, leaves you feeling very satisfied at the end.
What about since we don't have Enon here to talk about the piano part and playing the piano part, what about the orchestral part? What do you find satisfying in how Grieg structured your work as the maestro?
Well, it's actually, it's a good orchestration and a good use of the orchestra in a concerto format, because there aren't a lot of places where there's a huge danger of us covering the piano, for example. He was very judicious about how he used the orchestra in support of the piano and when we have our moments to shine and when we pass it off to the pianist. So, you know, in that sense, it's fun to conduct because it's well-crafted.
So this is sort of your opening night with the RPO is kind of a literary sandwich. Mm. You begin with the poetry of Lenau and you end with the fairy tale of Cinderella, mm-hmm. the Prokofiev ballet. You often put together your own suites for these things. Have you done it this time?
No, this time we're just doing the standard first suite. So I thought about it. I really did. But I love this score so much. I mean, I love Romeo and Juliet as well. And in some ways, I think the Cinderella score is even more fabulous, although we don't hear it as often as we hear Romeo and Juliet. And actually, I looked back in the history of the RPO, and we have not played very much Cinderella music at all in recent memory, going back quite a ways. You know, so I didn't want to bite off more than we could chew in this first program by, you know, putting together a 45 or 50-minute suite, as is sometimes done with Cinderella. And it's easy to do when you look at the complete ballet score. But we still have a lot of great episodes represented. There's 8 movements in all, and it ends with the climactic midnight moment, which is one of the most recognizable moments in the story itself and certainly in the ballet as well.
This is an interesting ballet. You mentioned Romeo and Juliet, and the treatment of these two ballets were very different.
Mm-hmm.
They really, people struggled with Romeo and Juliet. They hated Romeo and Juliet. That didn't happen with Cinderella. Why?
I don't know. It's because in some ways Cinderella, I think, was even more daring. Maybe they were just used to him a little bit more by that point. Who can say? But it's the score is just fabulous.
You say it's just fabulous. We believe it. But what about the score makes it fabulous, at least for you, Ward?
Mm. Well, Prokofiev's language, musical language, is so wonderful. You can hear, he's one of those composers, I mean, kind of like Strauss, actually, where you hear a piece by Prokofiev and you almost immediately know it's Prokofiev, because he'll make all sorts of great decisions, like, you know, the beginning of Cinderella's Waltz, for example. This beautiful, it sounds kind of dark, which is, you know, it's kind of this delicious, rich texture. But it's not meant to be a tragic moment. It's just, you know, the way he colors it and with the harmony and also the orchestration. It starts out with a tuba playing along with the low strings to sort of reinforce the bass line, but it gives it a totally different feel. It gives it this nice weight. And then when the melody comes in, the tuba stays with us and outlines the basic, you know, the structure, the skeleton of that melody. So you have this great tuba sound supporting the strings, which are in the lower register, singing through in this espressivo line, and then it just grows out into this wonderful blossoming of sound in the orchestra. That's just one example, but I can't think of another composer who would have chosen that instrumentation and those harmonies and that combination, and that's what makes it so fantastic. There are the opening, for example, is just, again, the way the melody weaves its way through the harmonic structure is just so compelling and so mysterious, and it's haunting almost. It's so beautiful. And Prokofiev has a great knack. I mean, I think he had a fantastic dramatic instinct. I mean, he can set us up and prime us for one thing, and then somehow, with this effortless transition, surprise us with a completely different mood, and these moments emerge. Moments of lightness and hope and beauty emerge out of what you think in the beginning is going to be this dark story, and then all of a sudden, without even realizing it, you're taken to a completely different place. And Prokofiev just has that gift. And he's also a great melodist, too, just like Mozart and Tchaikovsky. Prokofiev certainly inherited the great Russian ballet tradition and the mantle from Tchaikovsky. And even though at first hearing you may not think the two have a lot in common, I think they really do in terms of their gift of melody and their sense of form and structure and drama.
I would also add wind writing, because I think that they write for winds very similarly as well.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
It's interesting because we talk about Prokofiev and you talk about his wonderful gift for melody. Do you think that that is what ultimately saved him from the devastating harassment from the Soviet government that was greeted upon Shostakovich?
It could be. Prokofiev was an interesting guy. I've always thought it would be just endlessly fascinating to be able to speak with Shostakovich and Prokofiev, you know, back to back, and get their different perspectives and how they... Because we all are very familiar with Shostakovich and his struggles, and somehow Prokofiev managed to essentially dodge the bullet the whole time. And was that because his music was just a little easier on the ear on Stalin's ears? Was it because he was very politically astute and was really good at hiding it and making it look easy? Why was it? Was it a combination of all those things? I really have no idea. It's something I'd love to study more. But his music, I mean, Prokofiev is interesting because he was daring in a lot of ways, but he didn't push the envelope like Shostakovich did, so he didn't really evoke the wrath and the ire of the regime in the same way that and Stalin in the same way as Shostakovich. And maybe that was by design, maybe that was just a happy coincidence because his inclinations musically were more in line with their tastes. I really don't know.
He certainly got in trouble, as it were, with Romeo and Juliet. That didn't go well for him initially.
Right.
But in the end, it was still a win for him.
Right, right.
And there were certain things by Shostakovich that were never a win.
Right, right. And I don't think Prokofiev had to keep a packed suitcase by his front door like Shostakovich did. So it certainly was not anywhere near the degree of terror that Shostakovich had to live with for Prokofiev.
Well, Ward, this is your opening night. This is your big opening for the season. So a quick looking forward, what are you really excited about? And don't cheat and say, I love it all. What are moments that you are really looking forward to?
But it's true, Julia. I love it all. I mean, why do you think I picked all this music? Well, I'm looking forward to Beethoven 9. That's always... I mean, you know, I'm a huge Beethoven fan, and it'll be the first time we've done the 9th together here in Rochester. We have a great, great ensemble for that. I'm also looking forward to Isabel Leonard joining us in October. She's, you know, major, major, major star in Metropolitan Opera and elsewhere. So that'll be a treat for us. And I have to say we're spoiled this fall because with Inan Barnatan, you know, he's the first ever artist in association with the New York Philharmonic. Isabel's a big star at the Met, so we're sort of getting the creme de la creme of New York City here in Rochester, which I'm very happy about. And then looking forward, I mean, we have two world premieres coming up, which is going to be amazing. It's always wonderful to create a piece anew. I think Jennifer Higdon's going to be here for some, if not all, of the rehearsals and performances of her new harp concerto. And Alan Shawn is writing a new piece for our principal oboe, Eric Baer. So I'm very excited about that. And, you know, the opera is always a highlight for me, too. Closing with Carmen. I mean, there are too many highlights. If I keep going, I'm going to mention everything by the end of it, you know.
Yeah, I'm always kind of sad that you pick Carmen because nobody likes that.
Right, it's so unpopular.
I know. Mm-hmm. I mean, what were you thinking? Ward, well, welcome back into our studios and welcome back into Kodak Hall with the RPO. It's great to have a new season up and running.
Indeed, thank you.
Thanks again to Ward Steer for taking time to be here. If you'd like more information about the Rochester Philharmonic season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.